abusing drunkard who really had been a heavy-handed party boss from Sverdlovsk, since renamed back, well, returned to its old name of Yekaterinburg, you know, who was not in any ways by nature democratic. Maybe it should have been someone else. And if we were really going to be cynical, perhaps that's what we should have been doing. We should have been trying to encourage someone else to emerge. In classic form, we were, shall I say, badly interventionist enough to ensure we ended up looking poorly out of this process, but not so interventionist that we really got a figure who could have been useful. So what can this say about the future? Well, I think the first and most basic thing is that one should always adopt a Hippocratic approach to involvement with other countries. In other words, first, do no harm. Our actual levels of capacity to change what happens in Russia are pretty damn limited. I mean, you think of all the early boosterism about personal sanctions and how it was going to turn all the oligarchs against Putin and they were going to, you know, bring him to heel and such like. Well, has that happened? Absolutely not. If anything, this rather moronic policy has ensured that most of these oligarchs are now more dependent on the state than ever before. Because precisely the businesses that used to make the money no longer are. Therefore, they are dependent on those contracts that the government pushes their way. So, you know, let's have a considerable degree of humility and be very careful not to make things worse. We could, for example, by over thuggish rhetoric about Russians, or by seeming to support policies which actually, you know, can be spun as proof that we want Russia dismembered or the like. So that's a kind of an initial caveat that, again, we did not have the humility to bear that in mind in the 1990s. The second point is that there will be an absolute need for sticks and carrots. Look, ultimately, it's going to be Russia's decision which way it goes in the future. It will be the Russian people who decide what they're willing to accept, what they're willing to do. That doesn't mean, though, that we just simply sit back and say, we don't care what decision you make, we'll be fine, whatever. No, it is clear that if you want to be part of a world community, if you want to have the connectivities with the West that you absolutely want, and whether that's in terms of the capacity to fly your corgis to Switzerland, or whether it's actually the capacity to raise funds and buy technology in the West, and I think that's going to be a lot more crucial, well, that actually requires you to do certain things. And until you do, and whether that means letting Navalny and all the other political prisoners out, whether it means addressing the rule of law issue and so forth, but until you do that, you will not be allowed into that community. You will not be allowed those connectivities. I mean, that is one of the key sticks that we absolutely do have. We can just simply say, you are not welcome here until. But we also have to think about the carrots, about the opportunities. It's all very well just simply saying, well, the carrot is just the right to be brought back into the world community. But it doesn't work quite so neatly. We will have to address a whole number of issues. There are, after all, if we look at the sanctions regime, there are sanctions which, frankly, it's hard to say that they have any real impact on policy, but absolutely have an impact on ordinary Russians' lives. Things like, for example, banning flights from Russian planes and airports into Western countries, forcing people to make all kinds of expensive roundabout routes and such. I mean, are you honestly telling me that Putin or any, frankly, Russian leader cares about whether or not some Russian can fly to Paris or Berlin? Of course not. And if we're worried about particular Russians coming in, well, that's what the visa system is there for. But the point is, there are all kinds of things which we could relax at no real cost to us, no real cost to any attempts to maintain pressure on the Russian state, and yet which can show that we are not actually opposed to you as a people. It's not that we're actually saying all Russians are hateful human beings who have to be kept at arm's length, despite, it has to be said, the rhetoric of the occasional politicians. So we have to look at how we also demonstrate that there is room, that if you actually can go through this process, if you can bring about the reforms and change the behaviours, then we are indeed truly willing to welcome you. And for that, this is my last point, that requires us to remain hopeful about Russia. And again, I think this is something that, you know, actually comes out very powerfully in Navalny's words. That sense of there is nothing predetermined about Russia's trajectory. This is not a country which has, as it were, its DNA made of razor wire, that it will demand that it always be some kind of authoritarian basket case. Otherwise, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we always work on the assumption that Russia will be a threat, that Russia will be, at best, a failed state, at worst, an enemy or pariah state, then actually we just simply make that more likely. We provide less reason for reform, more reason for the kind of defensive paranoias which are at the heart of Putin's vision of the world. Now, at the moment, the people who have that view are, on the whole, Putin's cohort. And, blessed thing, they are old people, and in due course, they will die. And attempts to actually impose that will on the rest of Russian society, through everything from the new history textbooks onwards, do not seem to be proving that successful. It doesn't mean to say that they can't be that successful, especially if we give them a helping hand. So we have to remain optimistic about Russia, but not naive. We have to make sure that as and when it begins to try and move in a reforming direction, that we are not seduced, that we do not end up making shortcuts and allowing people to get away with theft, with corruption, with the seizure of elections. And yes, if that means that sometimes Russians are going to elect unpleasant human beings, well then so be it. That is the essence of democracy. If we are serious about democracy, if we are serious about national sovereignty, we have to give Russians the right to screw up, in our view. If we can do that, then maybe, just maybe, we can help the process on. So once again, as I say, I always like to end on a more upbeat note, and this time I even feel that I have the capacity to enlist Navalny to my cause. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. Yeah.
Sometimes it's a partial one. Sometimes it's a... Kimi sevsem kırmışım, dokunsam yıkmışım. Gitmek isterken yerimde saymışım. Kendimden sıkılmış, bıkmış, usanmışım. Daha yolun başında yükümden yorulmuşum. Yalnızım ben. Tutun elimden, yanmışım ben, hep yanlışım ben, yalnızım ben. Tutun elimden, nedendir bilmem, hep yanlışım, yanmışım ben. Dolaştığım sokaklar, can yakar anılar. Yıkık dökük geçmişim bitmiş.
kendimden vazgeçtim, kendimi bitirdim. Erkendi son için hayatı sevmedim. Yalnızım ben, tutun elimden. Yanmışım ben, hep yanlışım ben. Yalnızım ben, tutun elimden. Nedendir bilmem, hep yanlışım, yanmışım ben.
Ben belere Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Ms. Marilyn Stern.
Thank you, Bonnie. Welcome, everyone. I'm Marilyn Stern, Communications Coordinator for the Middle East Forum. It is our distinct honor today to welcome Mr. Amir Tahiri, Chairman of the think tank Gatestone Europe, who will address us on today's topic, Iran on the Brink of Economic Collapse. Born in Iran, Mr. Tahiri was the executive editor-in-chief of the Iranian daily Kayhan through the 1970s and is a columnist for the pan-Arab daily Asharq al-Aswat. A contributor to the International Herald Tribune, Mr. Tahiri has published 11 books and written for many publications, including the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. The Trump administration has reimposed economic sanctions on the Iranian regime, exacerbating internal pressures, problems, and tensions. Mr. Tahiri will update us on current developments. Mr. Tahiri?
Well, yes, thank you very much for inviting me and for the introduction. I'm familiar with the Middle East Institute for many, many years, and I think you are doing valuable work, not only on Iran, but on the whole region. Well, as far as the Iranian economy is concerned, let me start with a quotation by Mr. Majid Reza Hariri, who is Vice President of the Iran Chamber of Commerce. Today, you know, at a press conference, he says that the Iranian economy is in a dire situation. It would be wrong to blame the present situation on sanctions reimposed by the United States. Three other factors have contributed to this situation. The first one is that although Iran is at the center of a potential market of 400 million people, we have poor relations with all our neighbors, and we cannot have normal economic relations with them. The second reason for the present situation is poor management at all levels of the Iranian economy, especially, you know, the public sector, which is the biggest sector. Almost two-thirds of the Iranian economy is in one way or another part of the public sector. And finally, massive corruption at all levels, which has really created a system that could very easily run out of control. The situation is grim. The present line of the government is to blame it all on the United States and on sanctions imposed by or reimposed by President Trump, especially on the exporting of Iranian oil, despite the fact that the Trump administration has given exemption to countries, to eight countries that import 75% of Iran's oil, at least until next May. So this is the overall situation. The latest inflation figures is around 29% to 30%. Current budget deficit has almost doubled, according to government statistics. Unemployment is hovering around 14% for male and 19% for female. All in all, you know, all the red lights are blinking in and around the Iranian economy. And massive reduction in capital expenditure has also created a big problem by forcing the government to stop over 4,000 projects across the country, which means that many companies, especially small and medium companies, are going to close down. That's the grim situation at the moment.
Are those the end of your comments, Mr. Tahiri? Shall we go to?
Well, these are my initial comments. I prefer, you know, the question and answer session, because you know, you might be interested in aspects that I might have ignored.
Yes. Okay. All right, so then we will begin some
questions. I don't want me to read.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We would really welcome your analysis and hear your perspective before we open up the lines to the Q&A. So please proceed.
Okay, so the Iranian GDP, which was estimated at around over $500 billion 4 years ago, is now around $444 billion, which means a massive reduction. The increase in oil prices last year and before the announcement of the sanctions helped the government to have an additional income in order to spend on these various projects inside and outside Iran. But now, again, the share of oil revenues has fallen to below 17% of the GDP. The government has been issuing bonds to its own banks, you know, and some people tell me, I have no means of verifying that most of Iranian banks are in fact bankrupt because they don't have the reserves necessary to cope with all eventualities. The government revenue from taxation, which was around 22% in the previous budget year. In our budget year, it starts on the 21st of March. So it was about around the 22%, but now it has fallen to 19%, which means, you know, there is a much bigger rate of unemployment, means fewer people are paying taxes. There has also been a fall on the government revenues from custom duties and fines and other bureaucratic services and so on to, again, under 19%. The current account surplus, which was 3.9% of GDP in the previous budget, has fallen to 3.5% of the GDP, which is in line with, you know, the general trend in towards falling revenues and falling oil income. Export growth, which had topped 2.2% in the previous budget period, has fallen to 1.8% in the current one, which is a massive reduction. Whereas the imports have grown by 13.4%. Of special concern is the fall in non-oil exports, which had been rising quite rapidly by an average of 6% over the past previous 4 years. But despite the fact that the Iranian currency has fallen, you know, by at least, you know, 45% in the past 2 years, Iranian non-oil exports have not increased, but they show a slight fall, and maybe the reason is that the fact that Iranian currency buys fewer foreign currencies, so the imports are becoming expensive. So there is an element of import substitution that is taking place, but again, unfortunately, the Iranian industry cannot make use of this opportunity because it needs, you know, to import parts from outside the Iran, especially from the European countries, which again brings up the question of currency. And many Iranian industries that have been hit by competition from goods from China, inexpensive goods and so on, especially the textile industry, for example, they haven't had time to readjust themselves and try to fill the gap created in the market. But what is really of special concern is that this present economic situation, this dark economic situation, is fueling nationwide protests. Now that I'm talking to you, we have 22 strikes and protests by workers in virtually all over the country, from the medical personnel in government hospitals who have not been paid for a whole year, to sugarcane plantation employees, to steel foundry, to machine tool factories, to gas refineries, to truck drivers, and the government facing a cash flow problem is unable to pay the salaries. You know, they are negotiating to pay 1 month or 2 months and so on, and this has fueled a lot of resentment and led to slogans against the government's foreign policy. For example, why are you spending so much money in Lebanon, so much money in Syria, so much money exporting the revolution, whereas you cannot pay the salaries inside the country itself? And the standard answer that all this is the fault of the American great Satan is sounding more and more unconvincing to many Iranian ears. Okay, I'm now ready for questions.
Okay, thank you. The situation sounds extremely dire, and one wonders what the next shoe that will drop will bring about there. I see we have questions in our queue. Bonnie, could you please introduce them?
Okay, thank you. So I'll just let everybody know how they can ask questions. The question and answer period will begin, and we invite your participation. Please note that when there are no questions in the queue, the moderator will ask a question. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to identify yourself when your line has been unmuted, please do so. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. So we'd like to take our first question. So caller, if you wish to identify yourself, please do so when you hear that your line is unmuted. Okay, here we go.
Yes, hello. This is Richard Irving. Thank you very much for the comments that you've made for us. My question is that when you contemplate a regime that is in decline in the sense that the economy is gradually being ruined, where there's a high degree of corruption, this, of course, can go on for a very, very long time before the situation is corrected. Zimbabwe, for example, comes to mind. So what do you think are the potential catalysts to bring about a change in the situation? And in particular, what would it take to stop or curtail Iranian adventurism outside of the country from a military viewpoint?
Well, these are two different questions, and they are both political questions rather than economic ones, but I'll try to answer them. The first thing we must know about Iran's present situation is the political schizophrenia from which Iran suffers. In fact, we have two Irans. We have Iran as a nation state and Iran as a vehicle for a revolutionary ideology. And these two Irans, sometimes their interests coincide, sometimes their interests don't coincide. For example, if you look at Iran as a nation state, Iran has absolutely no interest in spending so much money propping up President Assad's regime in Syria, or expanding its influence in Lebanon, or trying to arm Palestinian groups against Israel and so on. In fact, from the point of view of Iran as a nation state, Israelis are best ally and friend, because like us Iranians, Israel doesn't want the Middle East to be dominated either by pan-Arabism or by Sunni pan-Islamism. Because in that case, you know, if there is Arab nationalism, like the time of Nasser, we used to be a victim of Arab nationalism just as Israel was. And if the Sunni version of Islam, the Islamic government that you saw in Syria and so on, takes over again because Iranians are Shiites, they would be the victims exactly as Jews in Israel. But Iran as a vehicle for a revolution must be an enemy of Israel. And this is why, you know, they are spending so much money and so much propaganda, carrying so many terrorist activities and so on, because the Iran as a revolution then can tell the Arabs, who are majority Sunnis, forget that we are Shiites, we are going to destroy Israel and succeed where your other leaders did not succeed, either in the name of pan-Arabism or in the name of Sunni Islamism or Muslim Brotherhood or whatever. So you see, this is a clash of interests between the two Irans. The same could be said about our relations with the United States. United States is the only great power with which we haven't, we don't have a bad history. You know, we have a very long history of enmity with the British, who have been plotting against us, chopping parts of our territory, attaching it to their Indian Empire, or giving it to the Arabs in the Gulf, and so on. With the Russians, we also have more than 200 years of many wars and very poor relations. To the point that, you know, when the Iranian mother wants to frighten the child, says, oh, the Russians are coming. The French, we have a bad relations with them too, because, you know, they stabbed us in the back with the Treaty of Tilsit under Napoleon. It's a long story. I don't want to go in it. With the United States, on the other hand, we have absolutely no poor relations. You know, the first hostility was started by us when we raided the American embassy and seized their diplomats hostage, and of course the Americans didn't like it, so the whole thing followed from there. But Iran as a vehicle for revolution must be anti-American, because otherwise it would be outflanked on the left. You know, the not only on the left inside Iran, but also on the left in Europe, in the so-called Third World, and so on. As Foreign Minister Zarif said that if we cease to be anti-American, we would become something like Pakistan, which means nobody would care about us. But if we are seen as a challenger to the United States, you know, we'll have prestige in the Third World, the left in Europe, you know, and the right in Europe that are anti-American, they will appreciate us, and so on. So, you know, this is the Iran's central problem. As a result, the two Irans cancel each other out, and they cannot agree and develop a genuine strategy that would suit the interests of either of them. And as long as this problem is not solved, I think Iran will be a source of problem, not only for itself, but also for the outside world, because a country that has problems with itself, it cannot solve its problems with the outside world.
Thank you, Mr. Tahiri. We have many callers in the queue, so we'll go to the next one.
Okay. All right. So, caller, you can introduce yourself when your line has been unmuted.
Hi, my name is Mike Cohen. I'm from Dallas, Texas. My question, well, it's kind of a two-part question. I'd like to understand where Iran's economy stands now compared to where it was before they came to the negotiating table in regard to getting the JCPOA done. Is it in worse shape or better shape? And then as a follow-up, if you look into your crystal ball, when do you think we could expect Iran to come back to the negotiating table again?
Well, you know, the first part, the Iranian economy is at the moment in a worse situation than than it was 4 or 5 years ago. President Obama, of course, put Iran on a life support machine, you know, by through this so-called nuclear deal, by releasing some funds for Iran, by persuading others to do the same, and, you know, give an appearance of normalization to the Islamic Republic. But the Islamic Republic could not seize this opportunity. Obama provided the Tehran leadership with a golden opportunity, and really, you know, President Obama went out of his way to bend backwards, you know, to help the Islamic Republic regain its feet, you know, rebuild its economy, become the principal power in the Middle East, and so on. But because of this two-headedness of the Iranian eagle that I explained, they couldn't even seize that opportunity. Obama, you know, as a favor to the Islamic Republic, took the whole issue of Iran outside international law. He created a parallel Security Council with the 5+1, because the Islamic Republic did not want to go to the Security Council and had rejected 6 previous resolutions of the Security Council. So Obama said, okay, you don't want those resolutions, you don't want the Security Council, I'll create something unofficial outside, which was really amazing. President Obama also took the whole issue of Iran's nuclear business out of the IAEA, just told the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, stand aside, once we have reached an agreement, we'll call you in just to play the role of an inspector, which was again unusual under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in fact, in the text of the nuke deal, it is said that, you know, this text is tailor-made for Iran and it will not apply to anybody else, which means, you know, that Iran has is given a special status. So that was really the fantastic opportunity for the Islamic Republic to normalize itself and return to you know, the general realm of international law and diplomatic practice. But they didn't. You know, they could not even pass a law to approve the nuke deal that they had done with Mr. Obama. They refused to accept the seventh resolution of the United Nations Security Council, which makes a reference to the nuke deal and gives it some kind of legitimacy. They wasted that opportunity, and now they are dealing with a new American president, a new American administration, which has set 12 conditions for them in Secretary Pompeo's statement. And the difference with the time of Obama is that these 12 conditions are clear and verifiable. They are not vague, because you know, President Obama demanded from the Islamic Republic was very vague. You know, you could, if you like, interpret it in any way. And of course, Tehran did interpret it in many different ways. So this is the situation at the moment. But as for the crystal ball and so on, I don't know, you know, how long this situation could continue. I don't think that bad economic situation alone would lead to political change. This regime must be defeated politically. Unfortunately, it has always managed to avoid political defeat by dividing its opponents, both inside and outside the country, by maintaining a veneer of legitimacy. So I don't believe in the primacy of economy. You know, that's a Marxist illusion, that the economy is the foundation of everything. You know, it's not the foundation of everything. What is important is the political cul-de-sac or impasse that the present leadership has led Iran into.
Thank you, sir.